Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the Great War and have around 6,000 members worldwide. For more information, go to our website at westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 1st of August 2026 and this is episode 388. In today's programme, I speak to Rebecca Clark about the sinking of HMS India and the experiences of the survivors. Rebecca, welcome to the podcast. So to begin with, could you tell us a little bit about who you are and how your background as a teacher, writer and historian shaped the way that you approach this very interesting subject?
Thanks, Tom. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. So, as most people can tell the minute they listen to me, I'm not from this hemisphere. I grew up in Melbourne, Australia, and met my husband there. I grew up in a beachside suburb. He was a townie who had a holiday house. And so I got up in the world a bit and married one of the townie boys. And visiting his house was where I sort of found this information and what kicked off my research. But as far as my background as a teacher, I was an English teacher. I wasn't a history teacher, English drama and music. But history and writing had always been something in the back of my head. At the end of school, I actually applied for a journalist's course. I got the teaching course, so went on with that. And I think that the main thing that has shaped that, being a reader as well, an English teacher, is being exposed to words. I think finding information, my first instinct was to want to write about it, not podcast it, not video it, not anything else, but to write. And so it was just an instinct, I think, that drew me into that.
So we're going to talk about some of the research you've done with connected to family members. Now, before we go on, who are these family members? And we've got the Clark siblings and Arnold Clark and Arnold Clark's letters. And how do they relate to you? And when did you first realise these personal documents pointed to a much bigger story beyond one family?
Okay, so a bit of the family history. My father-in-law was one of two children, himself and then his younger sister, Christine. Their father, Richard Arnold Clark, known as Arnold, was the youngest of six surviving siblings. There were four girls, and then Wilfred and Arnold, the two younger boys, grew up in Gravesend. The father was a pharmacist in the area, very active in the community. And the four sisters never married. The eldest, Dorothy, died during World War II, but none of the women married. Now, whether this was because of a shortage of men after World War I, whether this was because they were highly educated women, two of them went to Cambridge University. One of them did the maths tripos, Queenie, who's the recipient of most of these letters from Arnold. She, of course, wasn't able to get her formal degree because she was a woman. So when she graduated, women weren't allowed to get a formal degree. She was able to do the course, but not be awarded a degree. So these four women, highly educated women, I suspect one or two of them may not have liked men. Maybe they preferred women. That's my speculation and looking at some of the ways that they decided to live their lives. But the four of them remained very close, ended up living with each other, the three surviving ones later in their life, in the New Forest. And I call them collectors of things. There's other words for that. But when they all eventually died, the last one in 1984, there was a house full of stuff. And these documents, my father-in-law at that stage really wasn't sure what to do with them. So he just packed them all up, put them in a container and sent them to Australia. And so when it came time for my in-laws to downsize, it was what was going to happen with all of these things. And whether foolishly or not, I put my hand up to be the family archivist. And it was looking through these papers and letters and all the things that the aunts had collected and kept over, gosh, 60, 70 years by that stage, that certain things started to jump out as being valuable and interesting. And certainly Arnold's things were high on that list, because already it was something that I knew not many people knew about. It was something I'd never heard about. And so I think it's the originality of the story struck me.
So HMS India is very much a core of this story. So what drew you initially to HMS India as a subject, and why did her loss and aftermath stand out amongst so many First World Naval stories? And I just wonder whether we could talk about what is HMS India, or what was HMS India before we get on to how it's central to our story.
Sure. So India was a P&O liner. She was built in 1896 by Caird & Co. in Greenock, and served, well, she sailed between firstly the UK and India on the mail run, but also carrying passengers. She had about 400 first-class passengers, around 300 second-class, and around 400 crew. It was a big boat. And then she started sailing further to Australia. So she had been on the sea for... yeah, just under 20 years when she was commissioned by the Navy to become an armed cruiser. And the armed cruisers had a checklist of things they needed to meet before they were eligible for the Navy to be using them as an armed cruiser. And so some of those things were the ability to stay at sea for over 50 days with an average speed of 10 knots at sea. The ability to be able to be divided up into watertight compartments, and to have things like operating theatres put on board, sick bays. They had to have a good protection of their coal sources. So there were varying things that were required of these boats before they were taken in by the Navy and converted to armed cruisers. And the conversion was amazingly quick, as little as 12 days, to take this ship from being a somewhat luxury cruise liner to an active warship. They had to remove all of the nice things, all the glass and the carpets and the things that made it look special for the first class passengers, all got taken out. I suspect a little bit remained for the officers, but certainly a lot of it was removed. So what drew me to her? I mean, basically Arnold's story drew me to her. It was the ship he was on. And so we've got one letter that he wrote on board the ship while he was serving, that is a gorgeous envelope that says on active service. He drew pictures of the ship that we have in our archives. So it was his involvement with the ship that drew me into it. But certainly once I started the research and learnt about things like the 10th Cruiser Squadron and the blockade of Germany, things that are not usually spoken about with World War One warfare, the story became that little bit more engrossing, I suppose.
So HMS India is often described simply as a ship that was sunk in 1915. How does focusing on the men who survived rather than the loss of the ship itself change our understanding of what happened?
Well, I think it makes it personal, because it wasn't just a ship. It was a ship with 320, the numbers change depending which list you look at, 320 to 330 men on board. So that immediately provides it with a story. But also I think the involvement of the ship with the 10th Cruiser Squadron and the blockade of Germany and what they were trying to achieve, that opens up a whole nother narrative for the ship itself and gives it a place and a story. The work that it was doing, trying to stop things like iron ore coming in and out of Narvik, was one of its main roles. Give it a place in the World War One story. And so it becomes more than a ship. It becomes an active part of a story. And the men on board, their stories add to its story and it to them. For those who died, it was the last thing they did. They were active servicemen, but they were also family men. Like all the men who died on the front, they were participating in this awful war, but just in a different way. So I think that by learning about the men, the ship takes on its role and its life. And it isn't just a ship. It's a part of a story.
So I think it might be good if you could tell us what happened to the ship HMS India. So obviously, we're going to be talking about Norway in a minute, and we'll get to that in due course. But what is it? Its active service from 1914 to 1915, and how does Arnold end up on this ship of all vessels that he could have been on?
Sure. So it was the conversion of the ship started in April 1915, and it was about the 20th of April that it headed down the river. So the conversion was done at Scilly's Wharf in London, and then it moved down down the Thames and went right up around the UK and ended up in Glasgow, and its final crew came on board there. So it was fully crewed up by the time it got to Glasgow, and it headed out. I think the first voyage, active voyage, was in May. And it headed out and started its work at the northern end of the blockade of Germany. So working around the Norwegian Sea, the North Sea, particularly around the Lofoten Islands, the Vestfjord, that was its main area of work. It was always accompanied by two ships, so two smaller craft. So there was the Saxon and the one that I've now forgotten the name of. I'll find that out. It's a big book. I forget little bits of information all the time. But you're always accompanied by these two trawlers. And that was to make the ease of inspecting other ships more accessible for them. You were able to get men off India onto a trawler over across to one of the craft that they were inspecting, looking for contraband. The contraband changed on a very regular basis. I think as the UK became increasingly concerned at the activity of the war, they tried to add more and more things into the contraband. So it went from things like iron ore to wool to wheat to whatever that they thought might help them stop Germany. And it was German boats that they were focusing on, really, at that stage. They did pull up other neutral boats to make sure, I think, that they weren't assisting Germany, but it was mainly German boats. And you also asked something else.
Yes, the story. How does HMS India come to be sunk?
Okay, so it was U-22. It was one of the U-boats that sunk her. I find it interesting that when U-boats were first sort of introduced by the Germans, the UK Navy, the British Navy, sort of shrugged them off a bit, didn't really understand the impact that they could have, and so sort of brushed them aside. And then Lusitania was taken out by a U-boat, and all of a sudden it became quite real. And so they asked some of their ships to employ tactics to try and avoid the U-boats. They knew that they were there, and they would do things like change their speed on a regular basis, change their direction, try and make themselves as unpredictable as possible. U-22 had been stalking India. They knew that she was there. And I've actually got a really interesting report of the whole torpedoing incident from someone who was on board U-22. And that's really interesting because I've also got one from a man who survived India, and they are very different accounts of the same event, of course. So yeah, U-22 had been stalking India. Knew she was there. They definitely wanted to get rid of her. They'd had one sort of close attempt at it, and another U-boat had also had an attempt. But it was on the 8th of August 1915 that they spent a good afternoon just following her around, and it was that day that they got her. She came within 1.1 kilometres, 1,100 metres, and they let fly with the torpedo. And as Hashagan reports, it broke the surface of the water twice, and then it ran straight, and they heard it hit the boat, and it took 6 minutes for India to go down, so fast that only two of its smaller craft were able to be released. The rest went down with the boat.
And where was it sunk? Was it sunk off the
So
coast
it
of Norway?
sunk, off the coast of Norway. It's sort of closer to Bodø than it is to Narvik. It's about 6 kilometres off a little series of islands called the Helgeøya Islands, which are off Bodø. To any Norwegians who are listening, I apologise for my pronunciation. I'm Australian, I blame that. But yeah, so it's, and apparently it's a good 5, 6 kilometres down. That's where it is on the seafloor. The location is known, it's mapped, and there is some interest in getting a craft down to it, but nothing's happened of yet.
And so, what was Arnold's role on the India during
So
its service?
he was in engine room. I always pronounce this wrong. Tisifer.
Officer, yeah.
So he was down there. He had been, prior to the war, been up at in Glasgow, at Yarrow's shipyard, training to be a ship's engineer. So that's where he had sort of been, and when he signed up for war, that's where he was. Interestingly enough, his brother signed up exactly on the same day, not known to the other. It was just a coincidence. But he signed up there, and then he thought that he'd be going to Deal for training. He was actually sent to Chatham, which was where they were training men to be in the engine room, and then up to Granton in Scotland to finish his training. And then he was put on India. I'm not sure why India. That's at the whim of the Navy, who they place on what boat, but that's where he ended up.
And India was a coal-fired ship, wasn't it, rather than
Yes.
an oil-fired ship. So,
Yes.
it's essentially shoveling coal into fires
Yeah.
to stoke the
Yeah, they
doors.
had a big crew of firemen, of men who worked down in the boiler rooms. And if you look through the records, I've tried to place as many men as I possibly can, and find their birth dates and all the rest. A lot of them are very hard to find because the men who worked in the bowels of the ship like that, there were often no records for them. You're lucky to have their names, so it's very hard to trace them.
So what's the mortality on the ship? How many people are on, or how many crew are on the ship, and how many survive after U-22 does its work?
Yeah, so about we think there are around 320 to 330 on board. My records say about 124 died, and then the remainder were rescued in three different ways. Of the two ships, of the two smaller craft that were launched from the side of India, about 40 men rowed 6 kilometres to the islands, Helgeøya Islands. About 80 were picked up by a Swedish boat nearby called the Gotland, and then the remaining approximately 120, no, sorry, that's too many. The remaining about 100 or so were picked up by the trawler that was working alongside India, the Saxon.
Now, a large number of these men, or I should say, a number of these men end up in Norway. And a lot of your research looks at the sort of the internment of these survivors in Norway, which was a neutral country. What were the realities of life for people like in this country, and how did it differ from captivity, say, in a prisoner of war camp?
Sure. So I'll just give one little bit there. A lot of people don't understand why these men were kept and why some went home. So those who were rescued by the Gotland were allowed to go home because they were rescued by a neutral craft. Those who were either in the rowboats or rescued by the Saxon were on belligerent craft. They were on boats that had associations with countries involved with the war. And so because of the Hague Convention of 1907, which both the British and the Norwegian authorities had signed, Norway had the right to keep men who were involved in the war as internees. They already had a shipload of Germans there, 450 Germans on one ship that was down near Trondheim. So they had a record of starting this method of internment. So the India men were taken from Narvik, basically, where they were, to a little town just outside of Lillehammer called Jorstadmen, and to an army base that was already in existence there. The big change that was made was a big barbed wire fence was put around the outside of it. So that's the first thing, I think, that yes, they were not prisoners of war. They're still actually in all the records are called prisoners of war. So if you look at the archives in the National Archives Kew, they are listed in the prisoner of war files. but they are internees. So they had opportunities to perhaps leave the camp with an armed guard to visit Lillehammer on a Saturday to do some shopping. Arnold got into skiing with an armed guard. So he was allowed to, he and some others were allowed to do a certain amount more than some of the other internees. A lot of it depended on your behaviour and how, yes, I suppose how well you could be trusted outside of camp. I think that some of the men, particularly those who perhaps were less educated, who didn't have the ability or patience to sit and read or amuse themselves, got a little bit more antsy. So they perhaps experienced a tougher internment in some ways than those who were well-behaved and obedient and all the rest. So, yeah, I think the main difference is the ability to leave the camp as opposed to a prisoner of war who might not be, might not have the freedoms with an armed guard.
And just for my geographical knowledge, is Lillehammer well inside the Arctic Circle? Is it, as I would think of Norway, really cold?
It is really cold. So I was there in March 2024 and averaged about -6. Arnold has a graph that he took from December 1917 to March 1918, and the lowest it gets is -36. Ooh. So I'm not sure. I think it sits just under the Arctic Circle, but it's borderline. It's quite close. Whether it's reached it or not, it's cold. Yes.
Now, obviously, a lot of your study is the cache of letters that you have. You sort of inherited, so to speak. And what do these letters and those of other sailors tell us about their experience? And also, do these reveal things that I suppose standard records can't really describe?
100%. Yeah, absolutely. The records of the internment are actually quite extensive, which is great. And they're available for anyone to look at the National Archives. I've also been to the archives in Oslo, and there's some records there, which give a slightly different side of the story to the ones in the English archives. But I think the letters and those I've seen from other men, they just give you a personal insight that formal records cannot. And so they tell of the little things that are going on. A cow drinking out of a bucket just outside the door. The train crashes when Arnold was working up on the railroad, which is one of the opportunities he was given, was to work on the construction of the Dovrebanen Railroad. They give a totally personal touch. And I suppose one of the other ways that we see that is some cartoons and drawings that were done by Lieutenant Altree. That were printed in local papers that basically show the ineptitude of the English English sailors at learning to ski or skate or basically do anything escape. But all of these things combine to give us the human side of the experience and not just the formal records of.
Yeah, no, just reflecting on the ability of the British to do Arctic sports after the Winter Olympics, which for metadata has just ended in February 2026.
Yes.
So you discovered that, you know, many of these letters actually survive outside the family, particularly within the philatelic community. Sorry, that's my pronunciation. How did that realization affect your research, and what challenges did it present in piecing together the story?
So it was early the 2010s that my father-in-law had discovered a ship that had been discovered, the shipwreck of a ship that had been discovered off Perth in Australia. And so he Googled HMS India for the first time in a very long time. And the first thing that came up was a letter written by his father being sold in the philatelic community for a lot of money. We've seen them as high as £350. And he just sort of was gobsmacked to see his own father's name up there and a picture of this letter. So we've got about 50 letters in the family collection that keep popping out of books. I'll open a book that one of the aunts had and the letter will fall out. But I think there are now around 40 that I know of in the philatelic collecting community. And the challenges have been, in the early days, people valued the letters, the envelopes more than the letters, or the covers, as they call them. Some people got rid of the letters. So that's the first hiccup, major hiccup. The second thing is most people have been really happy to share, if I've got in contact with them, have been happy to share a scan of the letter. I've done trades with some people. I've got more envelopes than letters. Here, have an envelope, and they'll send me a letter. Some people have just kindly said, well, this belongs to you more than me. It's yours, which is lovely. Many people have scanned the letter in for me, so I've got, at least got a copy of it, and are happy for me to use that as I want. So it's in the book, it's on websites, things like that. But some people have just never responded to me. So I've been sneaky, and if it's on eBay and they've included the letter, well, then, as far as I'm concerned, that's for me. And if you won't talk to me, then I'll just transcribe it straight from the photo you've put on eBay. But I think that that's been the one disappointing thing, is the people who've been quite reluctant to even just share what they've got with me. But on the whole, the people I've dealt with have been incredibly generous. And I've spoken to many philatelic clubs, and I've had people there find connections for me. We don't know how these letters got out into the community. When Edith died in 1984, the eldest sister, who was the last to die, when she died in 1984, as I said, my father-in-law packed the house up, and had it ready, and just sent basically everything to Australia. But somehow all these letters got released, and we found the sale that they were put in. And this is one of the members of the philatelic community who came to one of my talks, and he went off and started researching for me, and he came back and he said, I found the sale that the letters were in. So we've got that far, but we just don't know now still how they got from the house to the sale, and then where they went from then.
And I should have mentioned, for sake of clarity, that somebody in the philatelic community is a stamp collector.
They
So
are.
people are interested in, obviously, probably in Norwegian stamps, in First World War British stamps, and this, obviously, once they're in the community, they're after the envelopes and the postmarks for the stamps rather than the
Yeah, and the
contents of the
sensor
letters.
markings. So they're interested in the sensor stickers and stamps that are put on, because there's very little World War I mail from Norway.
Again, it's amazing what people will find interesting.
Yep.
But it all adds to our story. Now,
It
your
does.
books balance intimate personal stories with a broader historical context. How do you navigate the line between family memory and rigorous historical scholarship?
Well, in the book, I basically almost divided it in half. I did a lot of the historical work early, and it was interesting. My mum and my father-in-law were both sort of over my shoulder reading drafts and things. And from mum, she's like, "Do you think we need all this?" And from my father-in-law, who was in shipping, "Oh, do you think we've got enough on shipping? Surely we need a bit more of the shipping historical stuff." So I thought, I'm never going to keep everyone happy, so I need a little bit of both. And I'll never profess to be an expert on shipping or shipping history. So I suppose I tried to gear that research directly into this specific event, and this specific boat. I've had, at some of the talks I give, some people ask questions that I'll quite honestly say, I don't know the answer to that. I've tried to give a personal approach to the historical, and then a slightly historical approach to the personal, I suppose. But for me and my interests, I think it's the personal that for me is the more rewarding side of things. And so it's, yeah, balancing the two of them and keeping the readership happy, because there are people who want to know this story purely on a World War I history basis, and there are others who are more interested in the personal response to that. So yeah, and even when I do my talks, there's sort of a division between the two, and I try and balance it as well as I can, because I think there is interest in both, and I think they complement each other. But yeah, I won't profess to be an expert, certainly, on World War I.
Oh, well, we know inside the certainly the Western Front Association cult, there's always somebody who knows more than you on a narrower subject, and will tell you about it.
Yeah.
So yes, it's an ever expanding universe. Now you talk now talking about the sort of talks you give. You work with a lot of, obviously a lot of the original envelope letters and ephemera. How do audiences react to these sort of, I suppose, tangible bits of the past?
Yeah, I think that again, it gives them something to link into. I think by having a photo and a letter, well, a series of letters, that a person's story makes the wider story more accessible. Yes, you can hear about a ship, as you said earlier, a ship that's been torpedoed, but unless that ship has a story attached to it, it was just a ship. So I think seeing all of these things, so in my talks, I have a slideshow. I always bring the letters and Arnold's scrapbook along with me so people can leaf through them and have a look at them. I think that's really important and people really enjoy that. I still find it amazing some of the things that people take away with them from it. And the one big thing that people take away is that the men who were interned were allowed the opportunity to take leave. Yes. So all serving men were allowed to have leave, and the men who were interned in Norway were still regarded to be serving. They were paid. And so an agreement was made up between the Navy and the Norwegian authorities to allow these men to go back home on leave. And I think pretty much everyone got to go once. They had to sign a form to say that they would have nothing to do with the war effort, that they were going purely for personal reasons. They were given 4 weeks to get there and get back to camp. And this is the one thing that people ask me about constantly. But again, it's because it's a personal thing and it's what the people were doing that I think makes it of interest to people. It's, as you said, it's tangible. It's what people were doing. And all these little things, and I've got things from Arnold that were his telegrams that accompanied his tobacco. I've got the graph I was talking about earlier, on all of the photographs. It makes it a real thing.
And so you know, you talk about the life of these men in this camp and their leave and life. What does it tell us? What does their sort of experience in Norway tell us about their endurance and the hidden costs of war? Because often we forget about that they are stuck in Norway. They are essentially captives in many ways, and things that weren't wonderful, I'm sure. But what's it tell
No.
us about their experience? Because often that is not known.
Yeah, so I think that one thing I bring up is, we've been through lockdown now. So we all know what it's like to lose some of our freedoms, some of our liberties. This is what these men were doing for 3 years in a foreign country where the weather was different, where the food was different. They protested at one stage against salt beef. That was impossible to eat in the middle of winter. Arnold's hut burnt down twice. So not only had he lost everything in a shipwreck, he then lost everything two times over when his hut burnt down. Because of course they're wooden huts with wooden fireplaces. And so he got into the habit of sending everything home, sending his photographs home, sending everything home, because if you left it there, it might not be there. So endurance-wise, we know of one man who went mad. Was Arnold writes he was taken off in a car, and I've traced him, and he went to an asylum not too far away. He died there. I thought he'd perhaps maybe suicided, but he didn't. It was pneumonia, but I think his mental condition, they report of him, they had to strap him down quite a bit. They report him walking around, not making any sense, couldn't form sentences. We know of one gentleman who returned back. He was repatriated during the period of internment, and I've been in contact with his great granddaughter, and he never settled again. He found it very difficult to stay in the same place and would go missing from home for weeks at a time. And in 1927, he left and he just never came back. Arnold's mental health while he was there was not brilliant. He speaks of if he had some cyanide, he doesn't know what he'd do with it. There was a condition that was named by a Swiss physician at the end of 1918 called barbed wire syndrome, referring to men who were kept as internees behind barbed wire. They weren't being beaten, they weren't being tortured, but they weren't able to do anything of their own free will. Everything was being dictated by somebody else. And it speaks of, he speaks of symptoms like extreme lethargy. He speaks of depression, of inertia, of an inability to do things even when you have time to do it. Arnold writes about being unable to do anything but sit there and smoke and think. So I think that they're the unseen challenges that faced these men. And then there was just the boredom. And as I mentioned earlier, some of the men who, and they tended to be the firemen or men who were working in the engine room, they'd get a bit rowdy. They'd find ways to get alcohol. They'd get a bit drinky and a bit bolshy and start challenging the guards. And a couple of them ended up in jail. One of them, for the whole internment, ended up being moved to a jail because he was considered to be, I think, a risk to the peace of the camp, as well as untrustworthy in his own behaviour. So, yeah, it wasn't necessarily a peaceful thing. But then at the same time, 8 or 9 men got married to women there. William Tilly married the camp cook, had 6 children, and there are Tillys all over that part of Norway now. I've been in contact with some of them. A lot of the officers did not live in the camp. They were, Commander Kennedy had a very large property in Lillehammer. And when renovating the property in the 80s, they found a box of his records that had his receipts for his fur coats and his cigars and his wine collection. And he had a chauffeur. So I think he coped okay. And the officers were in a small hotel. And I've been in contact with one of their granddaughters. And she said, it just seems to be all partying. Rebecca, I don't understand. I said, yes, well, the officers had a slightly different experience than the men did.
Indeed. And I suppose, you know, it's interesting. Why do you think stories like yours, in a way, are often so marginal in popular narratives of the war, particularly compared to trench warfare on land, you know, Somme, blood, poetry, etc.?
I think partly because there were more men on the land. This was a much smaller operation. So if we just look at statistics, there were far fewer men at sea or doing the things that Arnold was doing as there were on land. So that's the first reason. And I think that it also, I think that the 10th Cruiser Squadron and the blockade of Germany ended earlier. I think from my memory ended in 1917. So that perhaps then got swallowed up. I think after Jutland as well, that became the central naval story of World War One. You don't hear the blockade of Germany being spoken about very much at all. And it was a huge operation, that took in thousands of ships over the 2.5 years that it was operating. So I think, yeah, partly it's just that main, it's statistics, but also it's not as, and this sounds awful in some respects, it's not as dramatic as trench warfare. And I often feel like I have to justify this story of these men. And it's not a competition. And if it was, they can't beat the men who were stuck in these trenches. And Arnold's brother was there. Actually, the first letter he received after he was interned was from his brother, who was in the trenches in France. And that was the very first piece of mail he got to Norway, not from his father, but from his brother, who was in the middle of the war himself. So yeah, I think it doesn't have the drama, it doesn't have the tragedy, but these men still went to war the same way that the men who went to France, who went to Gallipoli, who went to Egypt, they still went to war, intending and willing to give their lives the same way that these men were. And some of them expressed a lot of frustration that they weren't able to be actively in the war. They were being kept from it. And I do wonder, Arnold never spoke of it, never spoke of the internment. My father-in-law knows now more than he's ever known through me looking at the letters properly. And it's been a very hard thing to sit and read through what he felt and what he went through. But yeah, I think that if we were to compare them, it doesn't fall up short, but it's so different that, of course, the trench warfare and what happened there takes precedence as such.
And I, before I come on to my penultimate question, what happened to Arnold after the war and for the rest of his life? So
Sure.
bring us up to I'll bring us up to the 21st century-ish.
Okay, so he, the first record we have of him after the war is in a repatriation camp in Ripon. That was on the 28th of November in 1918. So, as far as I know, he was still on the working on the railroad in Opdal, sort of further north, when the war ended. So it took a few weeks to get back to the UK. After, I think he was home by Christmas. By March 1919, he was back on board a ship. So he then worked in shipping for the rest of his life. He was sort of based on Union Castle ships. I think they're Union Castle. My father-in-law will be really cross with me. I should refer to my own book. But he worked in shipping in the engine room, and then became more of an office worker in the 30s. And during World War II, he was still involved in merchant shipping then, but not so much at sea. And then by that stage, they were living in Belfast, and he was working for Harland and Wolff in Belfast, and he worked for Harland and Wolff until he retired. And the very last trip he took was on a ship that his son was working on, as I think he was second mate at that stage. And he was given a trip by Harland and Wolff, and the ship he was on was one of his son's ships. And so they were able to take that trip together. Richard was working, and yeah, his father was having, I think, probably at that stage, one of his only holidays. And he lived out the rest of his life in Belfast. My father-in-law met my mother-in-law in London. She was a Melbourne girl. He was a Belfast boy, and he moved to Melbourne when he married her and has been living there since. Arnold died in 1978. The only thing my husband can really remember of him, we were born in 72, is that his grandfather was ambidextrous, and used to sit on his grandfather's knee as he drew him pictures with both hands.
And all roads lead to Belfast, which is where I'm speaking to you from as
Oh,
we
there you
are. There we
go.
are. There we are. And it's a beautiful day here, and it'll rain very shortly. Anyway, that's another matter. Now, finally, what do you want readers and listeners to take away from your work? And sort of, I suppose the sort of question, what difference will this make to people's understanding of the war?
What I want people to take away, I just want the story to be told. It's a story, as we've discussed, that is little known. I've been interviewed on another couple of World War One podcasts by World War One experts who knew nothing about this, never heard of it, and we're just fascinated that they've been working in the field for such a long time, and here was something they'd never heard about. And so, if they've never heard about it, well, other people haven't either. And I think that I want these men, and Arnold particularly, because he's our connection, to have their story told. When we went back in 2024, I took all the letters with me, and we stood outside the camp in the freezing cold and snow, trying not to slip over on the ice. And my husband and I were getting a bit emotional, and I said to him, "I don't understand. Why are we?" And then it hit me. I want to validate their experience for them. It is easy to overlook things that didn't have the trauma of trench warfare, that didn't have the impact that trench warfare had. But as I said earlier, these men went to war with every intention of doing everything they could for their country. And they survived a shipwreck. They saw men drowning around them and couldn't save them. And then they lost their liberty for 3 years and 3 months. And that's a long time. We were upset at Boris Johnson for keeping us locked in for months. Arnold's brother died when he was interned. He was by that stage back from the trenches learning to fly to become a part of the new Air Force, and never made it out of the UK. He died in a flying accident here, and he couldn't get home to grieve that with his family. He had to sit in this camp, and he writes in a letter to his sister, I didn't reply. I didn't know how to write. I didn't know what to write. I didn't know how to write, and I find that really poignant. And I want these men's stories to be told, because it is a part of the wider war story, and it's a human story. And so I've met now, either in person or through email, around 40 descendants of men who were on the boat. And we're all of the same opinion. We just want this to be a part of the wider story. There were other men in other internment camps. There were in the Netherlands, they were interned. It's a part of all of their stories. It's just a part of the war. And I want it to have its place.
And I hope this podcast will contribute to that. But the more important question is, where can people get the book from, and where can they book you to come and talk at their branch?
All right. So the book is called A Bear Chronicle of Existence. And that's a sentence from one of Arnold's letters that he writes, that there is nothing to report here but a bare chronicle of existence. It's available online everywhere. It's available through Amazon. It's available if you go to your local bookshop, they can order it in for you. It's available through my publishers, Austin Macaulay. It's available on my website. I have two websites, and you can get to me as a speaker through either of those. HMS India is my first website, hmsindia.info. And my writer's website is Rebecca Clark with an E. Slash writer slash speaker slash researcher dot info, and you can find me there. If you Google Rebecca Clark writer, it usually comes up. And yeah, I do talks all over the south of England. I've got another WFA one coming up in a couple of weeks.
Excellent stuff, Rebecca. That's brilliant. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Good luck with it.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Rusman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS 2195. Until next time.